From Community Public Radio, this is CPR Sunday. In New York, I'm Don DeBar with Eric Dreitzer from New York and Mark Sloboda from Moscow. Mark, Eric, welcome back. Pleasure as always.
Don, thanks for having us.
Don, thank you, as always.
So a lot of stuff this past week at the UN, apparently a framework for peace talks for Syria, and Turkey and Iraq duking it out. I guess we could start there, and I think it's Mark this week starts.
All right, so the most momentous thing over the past week certainly is Friday's rather quick announcement of a Security Council resolution, UN Security Council resolution, unanimously approved, that will supposedly lead start with a ceasefire and carry through with a roadmap, a blueprint for an end to the Syria crisis. Some of the things that the resolution notably calls for are it does recognize the territorial integrity and sovereignty of the Syrian Arab Republic. It calls for a unified, non-sectarian, secular Syria to come out of this. It does give a timeline for talks with the government between the so-called opposition and the government to begin within a month, a political transition within 6 months, and a free and fair elections within 18 months. But already, almost within the question and answer session with the press afterwards, Kerry and Lavrov were already disagreeing again on the fate of the Syrian president Assad, also on the composition of the terrorists. The ceasefire excludes specifically ISIS and Jabhat al-Nusra, al-Qaeda, and all other groups associated with it, and other terrorist groups. So this is already extremely vague, because other groups associated with al-Qaeda, well, that includes Ahrar al-Sham, which is just an offshoot of both al-Qaeda and ISIS, and is allied with them. And it excludes the U.S.-backed FSA, which the Western press has openly acknowledged are fighting alongside and under the same military operations room umbrella, basically, as the designated toll holders, the advanced U.S. anti-tank missile, the toll holders of al-Qaeda. Complete list of terrorists, which supposedly Jordan is compiling, is certainly a ground for contention. Who would enforce a ceasefire? The UN peacekeepers certainly aren't going to be able to be sent to do this. So then that's the question of who will enforce the ceasefire. And then there's the fact that most of the fighting forces on the ground, what we refer to as anti-Assad rebels, most of it being al-Qaeda, which is already excluded, Ahrar al-Sham, Jaish al-Islam, none of them are going to agree to any of this, because they don't agree with a democratic, non-sectarian, secular Syrian state. They want an Islamic state, just another Islamic state other than the Islamic state that's already been declared. So I don't see much hope for this. And in fact, immediately afterwards, the Russian foreign minister, Sergei Lavrov, was already saying, I'm not optimistic about what we've just signed.
One of the things that was interesting, aside from there were a couple of throwaway lines at the end where Kerry said something about Russians bombing 80% or 80% of the Russian targets weren't ISIS, but rather anti-Assad freedom fighter types. And Lavrov saying, well, you know, we have been asking for quite some time for coordinate targeting information with you. That might help. But the difference that's most glaring, and Kerry again highlighted it on Russian television, is the whether or not everyone agreeing that only Syrians can decide who leads their country. What that means for Assad, for example, if he were to run for president in the elections that are called for by this process and win, which he very likely would, or he certainly has a good shot at it.
A better chance than anyone else, and that has been openly admitted even by fanboys of the opposition, prominent, shall we say, mouthpieces to the Western media, the commentariat online, that there is no opposition figure capable of running unified against Assad and winning.
So, Eric, what do you think?
Well, excuse me. Well, I think a number of things. I think that what everything that Mark has said is true, and I think that Mark's somewhat skeptical perspective on this is not only warranted but probably the correct approach. However, allow me to present, if I could, a slight note or two of optimism in all of this. Number one, none of this process would even be happening were it not for Russia's military involvement in Syria. I think that that's quite clear. The United States has demonstrated that it has absolutely no flexibility whatsoever unless there is force being brought to bear against it. And in this case, that is precisely what's happened. Russia has taken a military initiative in Syria, and it has forced a political process to happen, a political process that may or may not end up going anywhere, but one that is certainly better than having no political process or dialogue at all. So
you can only negotiate with the hegemon from a position of unquestioned
exactly
military strength, yeah, and facts on the ground.
That's right. That's right. And the Russians understand this, and I think they understand perfectly why the United States is even at the negotiating table now. So at the very least, we can say that there is movement in a positive direction because, of course, those of us who have been following Syria closely since 2011 know the degree of suffering in the country, understand the mayhem that has been going on in that country for 4 years, understand how difficult the lives must be, or at least have an inkling of how difficult they are. So anything towards a peace process, I think, is a positive development. However, I do think that we should remain skeptical. Number one, I think that the question of these coalitions is really a big one, because does anybody truly believe that the Saudis are actually forming a counterterrorism Sunni coalition? I think that that notion is utterly discredited when you consider.
Well, certainly Malaysia, Pakistan, and Indonesia, which weren't even formed, they were a part of it.
Right.
Until afterwards,
the Pakistani representative apparently found out about Pakistan's participation in that coalition on the television.
Yeah.
So, you know, that is, I think, illustrates to a large degree the hollowness of this so-called coalition. And then, of course, the U.S.-backed coalition, to what extent they're even actually targeting ISIS is somewhat debatable. Obviously, their actual successful targeting numbers are extremely low by comparison even to the Russians, even if we were to accept the claim that only 20% of Russia's targets are actually Islamic State targets. That's still a far better success rate than what the U.S. has put out there in the last year and a half of their bombing campaigns. So what I think is that the facts on the ground have driven a political process, and a political process that also demonstrates, I think, unequivocally, once again, something I've been arguing for a number of weeks, and many people have said that they don't agree with me. But I do believe that there is a clear division in the U.S. political ruling class, in the establishment. I think that if you read that New York Times op-ed a couple of weeks ago from John Bolton, where he was arguing in the New York Times, he was arguing for the formation of a full Sunni state with parts of Iraq and parts of Syria, ultimately, of course, de facto would be governed by the Islamic State. This is the deconstructing Syria model that Brookings wrote about in the summer of 2015. This is all the same neocon objective of breaking down the country, splitting it apart along sectarian lines, and then being able to dominate these smaller little statelets. The neocons are still very much attached to that idea. I haven't seen any climb down from them, either rhetorically or in terms of their actual policy papers. On the flip side, I do feel that there is at least some sense on within the Obama administration, and at least among some of the liberal imperialists in Washington, that regime change, removal of Assad needs to be a secondary concern as they figure out a way to actually save face in Syria. Because ultimately, I don't think it's about the Islamic State. I think it is about saving face for Obama, for his legacy, and for Washington in general.
Yeah. If I could jump in there with just a second, I agree with what Eric said there, except that the division is not only among elites across the aisles. The division and the confusion is within the government itself, particularly between the administration and the deep state,
whether we're talking
the White House, the State Department, the CIA, the Pentagon. They are all sleeping in different rooms at this point, They're not sleeping in the same bed anymore.
And the
Congress. Is very little coordination between them. That is blatantly obvious from statements from numerous people. Chuck Hagel came out, the former defense secretary under Obama, this week with a scathing, blistering attack against Obama, saying that he basically drove him out, that his Syria policy is bankrupt, that the entire government is fighting within itself, and that Obama is basically just standing back and letting each one act on their own and against each other, and wants to wash his hands of the whole affair. I have seen some good suggestions from inside Beltway commentary that what Obama is actually trying to do is run out the clock as a lame duck and just letting whoever wins the election try to make any real decisions about what's going to happen, at least from the U.S. preferred perspective after the election.
You know, I think Ray McGovern has been saying this for a long time, you know, pointing to these divisions that were inside the government. And, you know, the first time I heard it, and that was a couple of years ago, I think. In fact, it was at least at the time of the so-called, you know, the alleged gas attack and the activity about red lines and, you know, putting it in front of the Congress and all of that. And I didn't give it much weight. To me, it looked like public relations, that they were each playing to their constituencies but had a unified policy. But, you know, now it seems that that's an accurate description of what's happening. You have a bunch of competing factions in the elite. And as Mark said, in the government, the White House is here, you know, aside from the CIA and the DIA and the Pentagon and all of that, which are still part of the executive. The Congress also is in an entirely different place. And then you have, you know, within the administration dissent, and then you've got the deep state. So, yeah.
How many times have we seen Kerry make statements publicly in the last 2 years about what's been going on, only to go home and to have that entire line basically edited out because obviously Obama didn't give him the agreement and that he needed to be saying those things.
Let me say one more thing about this, too, because there was something that caught my eye. I watched the State Department briefings Wednesday and Thursday. This was after Kerry had said, you know, essentially, you know, the removal of Assad, regime change is not our goal. I think he floated that like Monday or Tuesday this past week.
So-called regime change.
Right, so-called regime change. And so you had John Kirby running the pressers on Wednesday and Thursday, people were fairly aggressive with their questioning, stopping short, however, of saying, as he was, you know, spitting out the line, including that Syrians have to decide for themselves. This is a, you know, a Russian line that now being echoed by Washington, although we don't know what it means. You know, if you follow that to its logical conclusion, then you get to the fact that there's an election, and is Assad allowed to run, and B, if he runs, is he allowed to win if he wins? Nobody asked that, and I thought Friday that was going to happen, and instead they don't have a presser Friday. And they drag him up to New York, you know, to run the press conference there, which he clearly wasn't needed for. I'm wondering if they were shielding him from having to address that point.
Yeah, it's possible. I think that look, I have to say, you know, Ray McGovern said some similar things on Crosstalk on an episode that I was on, and I didn't entirely agree with him, and I still don't entirely agree with him, because I think that there's certain there is certain unanimity in terms of overall objectives here. I think that the divergence is a very recent thing. I certainly don't think it was happening in 2013. I think they all had regime change in mind. I think they just had slightly different tactics by which it could be achieved. Now, I think that Obama has come to a strategic decision, and this is really the Russian military involvement here, but he's really come to the decision that he wants to be able to basically, you know, hit the escape hatch and run out the clock, or hit the escape hatch and, you know, light and open up his parachute on his way down. Basically, he needs to find a way to, if not resolve this crisis, at least put in place the steps towards resolving the crisis so that he can politically and rhetorically take credit for whatever, you know, peace finally is brought to Syria. Ultimately, Obama's interests are political and public relations in nature. And now, I do think that to some degree, what you're saying, Don, is true. And I think that we've had this sort of dissonance between the talking points from these various, mouthpieces for quite a while now, partially because their policy is really difficult to defend. I mean, in many ways, it's an indefensible one. And so they play, you know, rhetorical gymnastics in order to try to justify these things.
It's clear also now that it's actually a failure. In other words, if you can't have regime change, how do you harmonize the rhetoric with the reality?
Okay, hold on.
I think that we should go ahead, Mark.
Just very, very briefly, you have to be careful with the government's weasel words here, because the U.S. position on this shifted somewhat time ago. What they desire is, they claim now, is a maintenance of the regime that is the institutions of the state, with only Assad and several other top figures removed.
Of their choosing. Of their choosing.
They think that the government can survive, and that the population in government-controlled areas will support whatever, head-chopping suicide bombers they
Obama,
put on top.
Obama and his people think that they're being, and I'm vigorously air-quoting here, think they're being smart when they say this, because they don't want to have a repeat of Iraq. They don't want all of the institutions to collapse. They don't want to see the military disbanded and all of these other things that have happened. So they think that what they're saying with the maintenance of the institutions of the state is basically not allowing the state to collapse, but they do still mean regime change. I mean, they do want the regime removed, and they don't want to be. Basically, Obama's looking at a scenario where he's going to have to go home empty.
You know, if you're calling for regime change or president change or whatever the term they're going to start using is, because you have an oppressive government, why is it that the military and the security forces are the ones that you're going to keep?
Joshua Landis has spoken on this very subject. He's one of the foremost Middle East experts in the United States, particularly on Syria, where he has a lot of connections. He's at Oklahoma State University. And he wrote very specifically in the last month about how it is impossible to have a continuance of the state, of the institutions of the Syrian state, the regime, and remove Assad and his political, base, his political support.
It's a complete,
they can't work.
It's a complete misunderstanding of the Ba'ath Party, of the Ba'ath system, of how the political system works. It's a complete misunderstanding of Syrian society, especially considering the fact that a lot of the people who strongly dislike Assad have left. You know, I mean, the people who stayed, I mean, to a large extent, you have a lot of supporters for Assad. So I would say, if anything, taking just those in, you know, the within the borders of Syria currently, I would say that Assad's support is probably even higher than it was when they had their last election. I think it's very dangerous to start talking about, we want to bring peace to Syria, but we do want to see Assad removed, because what they're actually saying, and this is, you know, the same thing that I've argued for a number of years now, what they're actually saying is, we want to continue continuation of the Civil War, but we want it to be on our terms. That is what removing the president actually means, and it's a very dangerous proposition. And I would also say too that if the United States continue, you know, they could say, you know, we don't want so-called regime change, but what does that mean? Kerry, when he says that, is calling into question the idea that the United States has ever been seeking regime change, which is ludicrous. Yes. That's the ultimate goal, and it has been from the very beginning. So they're in some ways, they're talking in circles, which is why Mark's opening comment, I think, is very apt. In other words, to be very skeptical that the U.S. is genuinely interested in a political solution here. Disingenuous is the name of the game for U.S. diplomacy.
You know, Mark was on Crosstalk. I don't know, when did you tape that? Thursday or Friday? With Zunis, and I forget who the other person was.
Joseph Olmert, the brother of the Israeli known political figure, Olmert, by the way.
Gotcha. And when he too, I think he was head of the information office or something for a while.
He was press communications under a previous Israeli government.
Yeah. So, and you know, they were floating some pretty absurd ideas there, including just a false narrative about the genesis of the whole Syrian conflict. And I thought maybe it would be good if you stated some of the factual basis for how this thing started, because the narrative here, as you know, is that there were peaceful protests against the government, and the and Assad personally, or in any event, institutionally, instructed a harsh response, shooting and killing protesters in the streets. Could you tell us what actually happened?
Yeah, well, first of all, you have to start back even a little bit further. We know from Seymour Hersh, from leaked documents, from French former government ministers who have come forward, that since at least 2007, perhaps 2005, it has been in the works for regime change in Syria, that this has been building up support for the opposition, plans to turn it into an armed insurrection, and it broke out with the, under the cover of the Arab Spring in 2011. And what there were indeed some peaceful protests, right, in the beginning, right? But what you have to understand is that these were largely led by a few thousand, shall we call them liberals? Some of them genuinely certainly are, you know, pro-Westernized liberals. Others of them have been trained by these U.S. democracy promotion agencies as, you know, as prep for, you know, the coming color revolution. But they are completely unrepresentative of Syrian society and of the crowds that massed behind them. And it doesn't take a sociologist to look over a continuous polling of the Syrian population, their values, their beliefs, to see that the majority of the people that backed this rebellion are rural, conservative, Islamist, even Salafist supporters. And when you take a look at the very first protests as they broke out in Daraa, outside, you know, the front men for the cameras, the tokens that are trotted up forward to put out the lines, you hear the crowds chanting, and I remember right at the time, Alawites to the grave, Christians to Beirut, meaning ethnic cleansing, kicked out of the country. Right. And this shows that these protests at its core, the people beyond the front men from the very beginning, were just a rehash of the Muslim Brotherhood clashes with the Syrian government that we saw under Assad's father, Hafez.
Yeah, can I jump in?
Yeah. Go ahead.
Yeah, no, I that is an essential point, one that I made on my show on Counterpunch Radio recently, the exact same point, that this is in some senses a modern form of the same old conflict between the Muslim Brotherhood and the Ba'ath Party and Assad's father, Hafez Assad, of course, famously wiping out the Muslim Brotherhood in 1982 in Hama after years of armed conflict and terrorism carried out by the Brotherhood. And so
he didn't finish the job, though.
Well, he is regarded in the West, in the United States, and in the mainstream history as a butcher, primarily because of that incident, 1982 in Hama, without any context about the war that led up to that to that incident. But anyway, I just wanted to say that yes, it is a rehashing of that, and I would also remind people that I remember very clearly reading it in mainstream media, like in Al Jazeera, the Washington Post, and others, that those early protests, you had some people, especially from rural areas, who were there protesting, complaining about the loss of subsidy. I think it had to do with heating oil, that there was a very basic economic concern that brought a lot of people out. But embedded within those very first protests were so-called armed protesters. Now, yes, that is a contradiction in terms. You're not an armed protester. You're an armed killer, you're an armed terrorist, you're within a protest, but you're armed, so you're no longer a protester. But that was the narrative, that the way that they spun it. I remember when the Syrian government discovered caches of weapons hidden in multiple mosques in the city, and that these weapons were traced back to outside forces, which 10 months later, the New York Times would document was the Syrian Muslim Brotherhood operating from the Turkish side of the Syrian-Turkish border. So there was a lot of this stuff was embedded at the very beginning of this conflict. This is in many ways the expose of what the Arab Spring was and how the Arab Spring operated. It was no different in Libya, just Libya had different political circumstances, but it was a similar scenario in which you had an economically based protest, and within that protest, embedded within it, you had militarized terrorists ready to begin open war. And that's exactly how it happened.
And with a war that they started in Benghazi, they actually had the outside fighters and grabbed the contents of the local militias headquarters and armed everybody in Benghazi at the outset. So they had a base of operations militarily. Let me just ask a quick question or make a point to amplify this. Here in the United States, you had the Black Panther Party march into Sacramento armed to the state legislature to protect their right to bear arms, which was being challenged by the legislature at that point. There's not a single example of Black Panthers going armed to a protest and firing on anyone, and yet they were exterminated in this country.
In the 80s, dropping bombs on Philadelphia in the middle of the city.
Okay.
Yeah. Exactly. Or, you know.
So the thing that the United States is basically standing behind as a valid expression of discontent, they didn't tolerate that here at all.
No, yeah, and it's certainly not a valid expression when it's a Palestinian who does it.
No, let's be clear about one thing. When these protests started, yes, there were peaceful protests, but there were no protesters killed by government forces until the point where these so-called protesters, armed at the time, tried to storm military barracks, military bases, police offices, and Ba'ath Party headquarters.
And you know what? I'm sorry. I don't mean to cut you off again, Mark. I want to say this, that it occurs to me that we saw the inner workings of this template, the sort of the innards of how this actually operates in Maidan. Because that is exactly how it went down in Maidan, with the snipers and the random killings that then generate the chaos that then radicalizes people, and so
provides
that
the pretext.
Exactly. And so in many ways, I think that Ukraine in February of 2014 helps us to understand Daraa and Hama in 2011.
We had in 2002 in Caracas the same thing, as it turned out.
Yeah, exactly.
Because what the media played at
the
time,
this formula with these unknown snipers who target into the crowd, providing the pretext and the justification for armed insurrection. We're repeatedly seeing it. Now, we have to remember that on the same time – You can trace this to Western mainstream reports. You don't have to go anywhere else. You look deep in the articles or down the timeline, you'll see that on the same days that the very first deaths occurred in these instances that I'm talking about, there were also Syrian police and military killed by these peaceful protesters. In fact, there was one incident where 100 in the very early on, there were 120 young military men slaughtered in their barracks, so their bodies mutilated again by these Muslim Brotherhood types. Now, in this debate that I had on Crosstalk earlier this week with Stephen Zunis, who is a professor of international relations, particularly Middle East studies at San Francisco University, he insisted on this peaceful protests and that Syria today could be saved because these protesters are stuck between the brutal repressive government and the jihadists. And only if both of them went away, then these liberal democratic unicorns could rise up and save Syria. And he knows because he went there and met a few of them. This is the exact same facilitating, useful, idiot narrative we saw out of the Western press and the commentariat in Libya, right, in Egypt, in Tunisia, everywhere this meme of the Arab Spring broke out and was used again. This is projection. It is pure liberal ideological projection of what these people want to see on populations that do – the majority are not represented by this viewpoint. And this is not Western Europe. This is the Middle East and North Africa, and the populations of these countries are largely rural, conservative, and in this case, that means Islamist and even Salafist. And these people like Zunis and others whom, you know, would love to see this liberal, revolutions overthrowing the government and transforming the area in the name of democracy. They're living in a delusional world, and it is dangerous, and it facilitates the regime change of the United States.
Let's look at Zunis's argument even in its own terms, because I've debated him as well. I know his arguments perfectly. Even looking in his own terms, take a look at Egypt, because it happened in Egypt, right? They're liberal.
What were the results?
That's what I'm getting at. Their liberal revolution happens. The Mubarak government is brought down by peace, love, and hugs and lollipops. And and what did you end up with? You ended up with a completely fractured opposition with no real leadership, separated by a Western poster boy Mohammed al-Baradei, a quasi-Nasserist candidate, and a few other assorted candidates, and no unity whatsoever. You had a unified Muslim Brotherhood behind their unified Muslim Brotherhood candidate, and you had the military unified behind their candidate. Muslim Brotherhood candidate gets in. A year later, and the Muslim Brotherhood wins because the Muslim Brotherhood is the only truly organized political force with a political machine.
It's not just organized. But they have the numbers.
They have a machine in place to turn out their numbers is the key.
But also these liberals, they're really only a few thousand educated Westernized. They don't represent these societies.
Well, that, of course. But my point here is that they're used as useful idiots by both sides in order to achieve what they want. And ultimately, it was the same groupings of people, liberal activists and so forth, who demanded that the military come in and remove the Morsi government.
And so
ultimately, what did you end up
killing,
with? You ended
killing
up with
hundreds,
nothing
thousands
but
of
slaughter. Nothing yes. but slaughter. And this is partially the point I'm making with Zunis's argument, is that it is such a painfully shocking misreading of the nature of the people, the nature yes. of the situation. situation, the nature of the country, the nature of the region, that it almost can't even be taken seriously. And let's not also forget, Zunis is connected to all of those NGOs like Freedom House, yes, with whom he works closely. And he was on the ground in Egypt. He was on the ground in Syria in the interests of the U.S. soft power machine. So let's not take him as some kind of, you know, objective analyst here.
Okay, we
and
also
was
have,
it the April 16th movement in Egypt, this sponsored by the U.S. Zunis was a big fan of this,
yeah, exactly,
civil society. And when it came down to the election, how much of a vote did they get? I think it was a fraction of a half of a percent.
Well,
of the
and they were pushing Mohammed El Baradei as the future of Egypt. Then they pushed some other like quasi liberal. So they couldn't even unify to support a Nasserist.
Well, the point is those people
liberal ideological projection.
Well, exactly. Also, it's also public relations, because the point of having those people out in front is not to sell it to the Egyptian people or the Syrian people or anyone else. It's to address it, the American people, to allow an American intervention in one fashion or another. Okay, so this past week, the day before this framework announcement, you had the adoption of a resolution at the Security Council dealing with and trying to work out a method or essentially enforcement of previous Security Council resolutions dealing with terrorism, particularly ISIS and Al-Qaeda and affiliated groups, but in general. And
cutting off finance to them in particular.
Yeah, and that was some movement forward. And again, pushing the Russian position. And Kerry even said afterward that what was agreed upon on Friday was proposed more or less in the same terms by Iran a year and a half earlier. So the narrative, the official narrative, even coming out of Washington now, is getting closer and closer to the positions that were staked out originally by both Russia and Iran.
But still, if the United States does not hold Turkey, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, Kuwait, and the UAE responsible for these financial flows,
right,
then that resolution means nothing.
Right.
And I think Russia knows it perfectly well.
I think that there's a couple of things that we need to think about here. And I'm just going to kind of throw this out there, because I don't know what Mark or Don, I don't know what you guys think about this, but there's a lot of reports coming out of the Middle East, out of the Gulf, particularly now, that it is not all warm and fuzzy in the House of Saud these days, and that there is major fighting within the regime, and that there are factional splits happening inside of Saudi Arabia that could be relatively significant. And I think that one of those divides, one of those splits, has to do with the prosecution of the war in Syria and the war in Yemen.
In Yemen.
Exactly. And I think that there are a number of voices inside of the ruling family there that believe that this young gun hotshot defense minister and whatever, that he is not only overstepped his bounds, but that he has gone way too far in the militant direction, particularly on Yemen, and that there are some who want to pull back from some of these activities that they're doing. And so I wonder to what extent that is going to have an impact on some of these issues, because what Turkey's doing is obviously unconscionable, but what Turkey's doing is not possible without Saudi Arabia coordinating those networks which emanate from the Saudis, from Saudi territory. So I do think that there's something interesting to be said, and I think that that's partially what Assad and the Iranians understand. Part of the reason why they're willing to continue to play for time, continue to be part of this political process, is that I think they know that time is actually now on their side, unlike a year and a half ago, and certainly unlike before when Russia got involved in Syria. Time is not on the side of the Saudis. And I think that to some extent, we're going to see a spilling over of these internal domestic conflicts in Saudi Arabia now coming out in some of the foreign policy. And obviously, those of us who want to see peace in Syria would be hoping that the logical articulation of that is that the Saudis pull back from fomenting war in Syria.
You have something similar going on in Saudi Arabia, and in Turkey, and even here,
even
here in the United States, because which we've described a bit already. And I think what it is, excuse me, is some planning among the elites for a disaster in Syria. You had the letters that were released, I don't know, a month or two ago in Saudi Arabia, where some members of the family were openly questioning the king and the policy in Yemen. And I think there was a direct, but certainly a collateral reference to Syria. In the event of a catastrophe, for example, you've had a number of attacks by the Yemenis on Saudi Arabia. And I know that there's been
very unreported.
Yeah, exactly.
And there's also unrest inside Saudi Arabia that's happening.
The taking of territory. That's the key.
The taking of several villages, the sinking of seven naval, mostly Coast Guard type small vessels, the successful launch of Tochka ballista missiles, taking out reportedly hundreds of Saudi UAE, and we don't know how many of their Colombian Mercs. That they've brought. I mean, that's mainstream news now that they're importing mercenaries from Colombia to help them in their invasion of Yemen. I think there's a lot of chatter going on about the division in the Saudi regime, but unfortunately, by the very nature of the Saudi regime, we probably won't know the real extent of that until the hammer falls and something actually happens, or it never does.
And then Erdogan has the same kind of conflict going on, which he's enabled with his adventurism. And here in the United States, what we were describing before, it seems that the administration is kind of carving the fallback position out to the extent there's one possible. Yeah. You know, the hardliners are still pushing, the neocons, and a number of the neoliberals still pushing, the deep state, the institutions, a number of them still pushing for an aggressive posture there. But since it seems like that's dead-ended or leads to World War III, perhaps, that in each case, Saudi Arabia, Turkey, and the U.S., a part of this is an accommodation to the reality that the Syria policy has failed.
Especially in Turkey. Take a look. There's a lot of people saying that Turkey is on the brink of civil war. In the past 3 or 4 days, Turkey has launched full-scale assaults on Kurdish-majority cities in the south of the country. Tanks rolling into the city centers. Hundreds of PKK fighters killed. These were largely novices. They're young. They're inexperienced. But there's reports that the PKK is withdrawing. They're more experienced from Syria, and that we may see pitched battles, not only in the Kurdish majority areas in the southeast of Syria, but possibly we could see it extend up into cities like Ankara and Istanbul, the guerrilla type action. And then we have the threat of military Republican revolt against Erdogan, which is always simmering below the surface, and which potentially could emerge out of all this.
And
so
let me
keep your eyes on Turkey.
You have the division also, like basically the Ataturk types on the one hand, the secularists, and on the other hand, this movement by Erdogan, the Muslim Brotherhood position, basically.
Yeah, exactly. And then there also, we should keep in mind that there is a potential for a Ukraine scenario in Turkey as well, because Erdogan and his ruling party has been stoking these Turkish fascist groups and really been providing them with political cover. The Grey Wolves and some of these other groups that have actually taken on and actually committed acts of violence against Kurdish people in the capital, in other cities in the country. They've torched Kurdish-owned businesses. They've attacked the HDP headquarters, that is the pro-Kurdish political party in Turkey. And so undoubtedly, if we see open conflict against the Kurds, you're going to see the incorporation of these fascist gangs in terms of street violence. And this is something that obviously the people of Ukraine know all too well.
You have an interesting dance going on, though, with Erdogan while he's doing this, spending his time with Barzani.
Yeah, well, he has to, because of course Barzani and Talabani are the two most important clans in Iraqi Kurdistan, and they're deeply embedded with Israel. They're in bed with the United States, and they have been for a couple of decades at least. And the Turks desperately need the sort of dare I call them comprador Kurdish Iraqis in order to be on the same page with them if they want to be able to pursue their plans for northern Iraq, for Syria, and for the region. Remember that, you know, when we call the strategy neo-Ottoman, it's not like, you know, a catchphrase. You know, I mean, it really does capture some of the thinking that Erdogan really has. He sees this as
they call it that themselves. They're right. Not shy about that.
Right. But neo-Ottoman doesn't simply mean rebuilding the Ottoman Empire. It's the description of a mindset, a mentality, an ideology, and it's that ideological framework through which Erdogan is viewing all the events in the region.
And there's also important to remember that Barzani's oil smuggling networks out of Iraqi Kurdistan to avoid shipping the oil through the government in Baghdad. These framework of smuggling oil from Iraqi Kurdistan, northwestern Iraq, into Turkey, this was the prototype and what the Daesh, the ISIS oil smuggling routes have been running parallel to.
Yeah, and also, exactly right, and also, this is the reason that the U.S. ousted Maliki. It had nothing to do with corruption. It had nothing to do with, you know, sectarianism or whatever. Those were all the, you know, the reasons that were put out there for political consumption. It really had to do with the fact that Maliki refused to allow the Iraqi Kurds and the Kurdish leadership to sell oil directly to Western oil corporations without having to go through Baghdad. In other words, the Kurds were running an oil program that was a de facto independence program. And it was the fracturing of the country that Maliki rejected. And that's one of a number of reasons why they actually eliminated Maliki from the government.
Yeah. I want to point out a few security matters on the ground before we close on Syria, because I think they're important. One is the Syrian Arab Army, backed up by the Russian Air Force, the Iranian trained militias, Hezbollah, continue to roll up territory, most particularly in North Latakia, where they've basically wiped out the Al-Qaeda Jabhat al-Nusra nest that was supported by Turkey up there, that this SU-24 downing was all about, the protection of these so-called Turkmen, al-Nusra. They're wiped out. Essentially, there's one holdout town, Salma, that is being surrounded at this moment. But already the Syrian Arab Army has reclaimed five border points and are looking the Turkish military right in the face across the border. Same thing around Aleppo. We continue to see gains by the Syrian Arab Army and out towards Palmyra. The U.S. has been reporting that they consider their air force grounded in most of western Syria because of the S-300 and S-400 air defenses that the U.S. Russia has put up. They are no longer flying anything but drones in much of Syria at this point, and they are not happy about it. But we have seen a coalition attack on an Syrian encampment in south central Syria. The U.S. tried to blame this on Russia quite bizarrely, but this is a really important incident because it was far more than likely not the U.S. themselves, but perhaps Qatar or Saudi Arabia. And this was the first time that we know of that Syrian government forces were directly attacked by coalition aircraft. This is followed a couple weeks later by the U.S. accidentally bombing Iraqi troops in Iraq that were also fighting ISIS. And just on Saturday evening, Israel once again bombed in the heart of Damascus, killing a top Hezbollah commander and a Syrian militia leader. So we saw all again, the coalition, the U.S., Israel, all essentially acting as ISIS's air force still largely with impunity. We know that Russia won't fire on Israel. The question is, will they actually fire on Turkish Air Force like Putin has promised? Putin openly dared Erdogan to send to violate Syrian airspace again during a State of the Union speech and a question and answer session, annual question and answer session with the press in Moscow. So those are some really important military things to be looking at.
Let me ask you about that last thing. If Russia, in fact, will not fire on Israeli planes, is Israel going to become the proxy for air attacks against the targets that the United States would like to see hit?
No, I don't think so. I think that this through similar contracts, Iraq 1, Iraq 2, so on, the Israelis have to play a really low-key role because of still the simmering hatred that many Sunni Muslims in particular feel towards Israel. Israel's strikes have almost entirely been towards Hezbollah. And the fact that Hezbollah is fighting ISIS, you know, fighting al-Qaeda doesn't seem to bother them. They still feel free to bomb Hezbollah in Syria with absolute impunity. And I think that is what they will continue to be focused on.
So it's a target of opportunity, basically. They
it's a target of opportunity.
Got it. Okay. Eric?
Yeah, well, I want to shift gears and talk a little about Venezuela if we could. I don't know if I'm
right. That's all you. You talk for the rest.
We got about I've hogged the mic enough. Go ahead.
Well, so basically, for those who don't follow me regularly, I just got back from Venezuela last week. I was there for the elections on December 6th, and it was a momentous election, a very important one, because it was really the reassertion of control by the right-wing opposition, the pro-U.S., pro-neoliberal capitalist opposition in the country. They won a supermajority in the National Assembly, and this is of course going to have major implications for the future course of the government, the Bolivarian Revolution, because quite frankly, the right wing wants to dismantle everything that has been gained, has been built by Hugo Chavez and by the PSUV, the Socialist Party of Venezuela. Just to give a little bit of a slice of what people were saying the day after the election, I rode the metro cable, these elevated, you know, cable cars that go high above the city that connect the poor neighborhoods up in the hills down with the rest of the city. And I spoke with a young woman who had voted for the Socialist Party. She had voted Chavista. And she said that she was devastated by the fact that people in her neighborhood, a neighborhood that had benefited so directly from government programs, because it was the Hugo Chavez government that built the cable line that connects her neighborhood to the rest of the city, that they would betray the party that did this for them and vote for the capitalist opposition. She said, and she didn't mince her words at all, she said that some of them voted out of ignorance and some of them voted in a way because they're ungrateful. And this is a major theme that I saw coming up over and over again, that people who were voting for the opposition were actually not supportive of the opposition in and of itself. They were voting as a rebuke against the current government, against the party, against the economic conditions that are plaguing the country. I could tell you that the economic situation there is quite dire. Inflation is a major, major problem. The official exchange rate is 6.5 bolivars to a dollar. The unofficial exchange rate is about 800 to a dollar. It is a very difficult situation. A lot of shortages, scarcity, which is actually manipulated and manufactured by the capitalist ruling class in that country. I'm trying to run through a bunch of information here for people in a short period of time. I met with the UN ambassador, a former UN ambassador from Venezuela, who's trained as an economist. And he said that to a large extent, there's are two factors that are really driving the economic crisis in the country. One is, of course, the collapse of global oil prices.
Orchestrated by Saudi Arabia. Exactly. Targeting Russia, Iran, and Venezuela. Venezuela as a side benefit
exactly.
to the United States.
That's exactly right. And Venezuela is about 95% revenue dependent upon oil revenue. Right. So a collapse from a high of about 140 to a low below 35, that's a loss of more than 85% of the revenue for the country. Now, that combined with an economic war is really a major problem. And there's various ways that this economic war is happening. You have these little, they're like little pockets of contraband trade happening along the border with Colombia, where you have people coming in buying very cheap subsidized gas in Venezuela, taking it to the border, selling it for a huge profit into Colombia. You have other contraband items such as gold being sold along the border with Colombia, such that in 2014, Colombia became a net exporter of gold, despite the fact that Colombia produces no gold. So that gold that has been exported out of Colombia is Venezuelan gold being essentially smuggled out of the country. And all of that capital that's bleeding out of the country, it's not coming back. And so there's major crises. And so another thing that Julio Escalona, this former UN ambassador, said, he gave an example that I thought was pretty striking. He said that there's one company that dominates the chicken processing for Venezuela. I think more than 70% of all of the chicken in the country is processed by this one company with their major plant. And the owner of the company, this very rich and powerful Venezuelan, very right wing, shut down the factory and continues to pay the workers not to produce, not to work, not to put chicken into circulation. And so now you have shortages of chicken, you have shortages of beans, you have shortages of other staple foods, all of which is chalked up to the fact that these distribution networks, these processing and distribution networks, were not seized forcibly by Hugo Chavez, despite the fact that the West calls him a dictator. They were not expropriated from the class as they were in Cuba. And so some of these problems still persist in Venezuela. So the shortages and the scarcity are definitely to a large extent manufactured. The hyper speculation betting against the currency is driving it down even further, along with a number of government mistakes. Now, very quickly, I know we're almost out of time. I just want to say, since the election has happened, President Maduro has tried to respond as vigorously as he can. He called for the resignation of all of his ministers, his entire cabinet, reorganizing the government. They have pushed very strongly in the last few days, using some of the enabling powers that he has, to push through an anti-Monsanto, anti-GMO bill that is now pushed through, and to push through protections for El Cuartel, which is Chavez's tomb. They have now transferred that into essentially a public-private trust so that it can't simply be privatized and destroyed. They have moved heavily to protect the workers' law, which protects pensions, workers' benefits, workers' rights, a number of other issues. All of these things the right wing has said they want to attack when they come into power. So January 5th, they take their seats. This is a major conflict to watch. What's going to happen when that right wing takes their seats in the National Assembly? If they push too hard, if they push, this is what I heard from everybody in Venezuela, whether supportive of the government or anti-government, they all said that if the right wing pushes too hard against the Bolivarian constitution, which is the most progressive anywhere in the world, and if they push hard against the legacy of Hugo Chavez and all of the programs, all of the things that have been built, you will see a civil conflict in that country. Now, the question I have, and this is what I would leave people with, is the right wing interested in simply reforming away the Bolivarian Revolution, or are they looking to provoke a civil war? There is a very real potential in Venezuela for a civil war. And if the right wing wants to deliberately stoke one, they very easily could. Because I'll tell you right now, every single person I spoke to said quite clearly that they will turn out into the streets to defend the revolution if they have to.
And you're seeing some of that in Argentina.
What will the military and the security services?
As it stands right now, the military still looks very much united behind the government. Remember, the military received their ideological training from Hugo Chavez and their military and ideological training in Cuba. This is a military that is very indoctrinated in an anti-imperialist mode. This is what they say at their own ceremonies, that they are the vanguard of anti-imperialism and blah, blah, blah. I don't know all the language that they use there, but basically, the army, it seems that at this point, is still very much united behind the government. The street police, on the other hand, the Guardia Nacional, that is a less precise instrument there. They may be less reliable. So there's a lot of competing interests here. But I will say, once again, and this I heard from every single person I spoke to, including those who dislike the government, that if the right wing oversteps their mandate, if they push too hard, they could provoke a civil war in that country, because the vote was not a vote for neoliberalism. It was not a vote against socialism. 5 million Venezuelans, despite all of this, still voted for socialism, still voted for anti-imperialism. Those 5 million people are not going anywhere. If the right wing wants to start a war, if the U.S., I should say, wants to start a war, they certainly could. And with the rightward shift in Argentina, a rightward shift in Brazil against Dilma Rousseff with the impeachment, you're seeing a process in Latin America trying to counteract everything that's happened over the last decade and a half. But I think that these movements are embedded quite deeply in the fabric of these societies. And if the U.S. pushes too hard, we could see a literal war on the South American continent.
And we're going to end it there. Eric and Mark, thank you very much. A pleasure as always.
Thank you.
You've been listening to CPR Sunday with Eric Dreitzer and Mark Sloboda. I'm Don DeBar, your host. Look forward to seeing you drop in again next week. Thanks for listening.